Tom Shalhoub, back with the Tom Shalhoub Show. Okay, here's a subject I love to talk about because it is very interesting, one. And two, I don't know that much about it. I mean, I have opinions about things, but sometimes I need clarification. And so we're going to keep the lines open as well. The number is 833-852-4866. If you have any questions, if you have any comments, and we often do get a lot of feedback from you guys on this because so many people have been touched by the opioid crisis. We have a bill now, an opioid bill that's working its way through our Congress, and I'm generally skeptical of bills on the national level, their ability to solve America's problems. So my skepticism about this bill is just based on that, just based on the fact that oftentimes I think it's very difficult for legislators to be able to craft legislation that helps anybody because you have so many special interests and things like that coming in. So I want to ask an expert about his opinion on the opioid crisis and on the bill. Dave Chase is with me, co-founder of Health Rosetta, author of the new book, The Opioid Crisis Wake-Up Call. Good title for this subject, at least, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, so let's just go to the title of your book. Do we need a wake-up call? Is your book the wake-up call, or is the crisis itself the wake-up call?
The crisis itself, once you dig in, you realize that the crisis isn't an anomaly. Mm-hmm. It actually is our healthcare system. You know, unlike something like HIV or polio that came from outside, this is a self-inflicted wound by our own healthcare system.
Wow. Yeah, this is good. This is the perfect subject for this discussion. So how did we get to where we are? I was born in 66. So the drug culture from when I was born till now, it was always about, you know, Woodstock, drug use, pot. Then you had the 80s, cocaine, and we moved through different crises made the headlines and often, you know, filled our prisons. We had the crack epidemic in the 90s, and we all had these different epidemics. Is this the first one, the opioid crisis? You're saying that it came from the establishment.
Yeah, if you look at most, even the people who are overdosing today, most of those people started with following doctor's orders. You know, they came in for something like lower back pain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though there's no evidence that an opioid is the best treatment for that, there was a lot of push to prescribe those. And we had extraordinary rates. We still do have extraordinary rates of prescriptions for opioids relative to other countries. And, you know, you have people like Rush Limbaugh is a good example. You know, following doctor's orders, back pain, became addicted. There's mm-hmm. all kinds of examples like that. And so that's what makes this particularly unique. Sure, there's some recreational that's come in, particularly as, you know, somebody walks out with a 30 or 60 or 90 day supply. They don't use all of it. Young people sometimes will do that. That's certainly one piece of the puzzle. But the majority of this is people following doctor's orders.
What's what do most people take for pain? Is it something in the Tylenol category? Is that the most popular pain relief?
Yeah.
Okay,
you know,
so
Tylenol, you know, and aspirin, you know, basically.
And then what do you have after that?
Minor stuff.
You want to move up just from Tylenol. What else do we do? We have something before the opioids?
I mean, there are some basically not mm-hmm. In terms of medications. I mean, there's some more potent, you know, versions of ibuprofen that just have more of it, but it's basically the same thing. And it's just the level of dosage that changes.
Yeah. So opioids are, I want to make sure I know what, you know, I've taken Tylenol with codeine. Is that an opioid?
There is a little bit of opioid in codeine, but it's a very small amount. But generally when people talk about opioids and where the problems really come in, it primarily boils down to brands you've heard like Percocet, Vicodin, Oxycontin. Those are probably the three most common ones that are pretty heavy duty.
And are all three of those? Because, yeah, I know all of three of those names. Oxycontin, to me, seems, you know, it's got the most that name sounds harsh to me, like Oxy, you know, the Oxy crisis. Percocet sounds like something I've been hearing my whole life. Is Percocet as powerful as OxyContin?
It's not, no. Uh-huh. OxyContin was really initially developed for kind of end-of-life pain, you know, associated with cancer and so on. But then it got really aggressively marketed and popularized, and there was this myth that was really put out there based on very specious data,
yeah,
that it wasn't addictive. And there was this, at the same time, frankly, pain had probably been undertreated. And so there was some awareness of this, and, you know, there was this notion of pain as a fifth vital sign that came out of the VA that then got popularized, and that became a big push around that, that, hey, we got to look at this like a vital sign, just like blood pressure or heart rate. And that really amped up the attention on it. And it seemed like this was a great situation where you had something that wasn't addictive that could handle that. But, of course, usually when something sounds too good to be true, it's the case.
Yeah. So what is the solution? I don't know if you've looked at this, the legislation that's going on. I know part of the legislation, at least, they're trying to pass a bill to stop the flow of things like fentanyl through the mail. And there's also fentanyl, and I think bad fentanyl coming from China and things like that, right? So they're trying to tackle that. What's your, you know, the only reason I said I'm cynical about legislation is because I'm generally cynical about big pieces of legislation. But what's your take on the bills that are going through Congress now?
Well, it's, you know, for the most part, they are good elements of it, but they're pretty much half the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think your skepticism is very logical, because some of the past legislation, you could argue, either had no impact or made things worse. Because if people are heavily addicted and you suddenly cut off supply, it doesn't get rid of the addiction. That's what really has fueled the rise of use and ultimately overdose of heroin and fentanyl. So there's some good elements. You know, you mentioned a couple. There's some other elements which starts to get at some of the solution of pursuing non-opioid pain management. But if you look at the problem, you know, I'd use the analogy of a bunch of people show up at the emergency department that have been poisoned. You know, certainly you want to stabilize the patient, which is great,
mm-hmm.
But you got to go figure it out. You know, was there some salmonella outbreak or some other issue going on? And most of the legislation to date is largely around, you know, kind of stabilizing the patient versus going upstream. And so there's elements of that that have clinical implications that they really don't get at in terms of one of the things that's really created fertile ground for the opioid crisis is how badly we've undermined primary care in this country and sort of forced it through an insurance model.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we, you know, I gave back pain, that's a good example of how we've really botched things. You know, physical therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, if they're paid at all, they're very difficult to access as a patient, yet you can really get a quick and easy prescription to these very addictive medications.
Yeah. Is there anything in legislation or in any legislative pipeline that's addressing that? Because that's something people have been talking about this for years, and like wellness over drugs, and, you know, but they've never been able to prod the system to do that. And you're saying it comes from basically a reimbursement perspective, that the insurance companies just find it, is it that they find it easier to reimburse the drugs, or it's just, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, it is easier, and it's just, it's something where there's margin. You know, there's not margin in physical therapy. There's all kinds of shenanigans. You know, there's been some press about how the money flows within the pharmaceutical supply chain. There's what are called pharmacy benefit managers, and there's all kinds of, you know, in any other context, we'd call it kickbacks,
mm-hmm.
But there's basically different methods that make it very profitable for, yes, the PBMs, which many of them are owned by insurance companies,
yeah,
but then the insurance companies and the whole supply chain can make a lot of money off of that. And that's really the, you know, there's an element of the legislation that's good, where they're expanding the sunshine on payments to other types of professionals besides doctors. Like, that's good. But what they don't do is expand sunshine to the other half of the equation, which is the business flow. That's a massive influence on the system. All the money that's being made that I was just alluding to, that if you don't put sunshine on that, you don't get at the problem, because that drives a lot of how benefit plans are designed by insurance companies and why particular things are pushed and others aren't.
Yeah. So is it the structure of how we pay for healthcare that has to change to start to address some of these issues? Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you look at the places like, I have a case study in the book, Rosen Hotels, where if you look at the prescribing rates there, it's 1/6 of the typical employer, even though they have very physically demanding jobs, you know, as maids and maintenance workers and so on, because they get the primary care piece right. They make primary care basically available for free to their employees, make PT available for free to the employees. You know, They do the smart things where, you know, you essentially a smart plan makes the smart decisions free and the bad decisions expensive, which most plans don't do.
Yeah. And that's it's a hotel chain again?
Yeah, it's a regional hotel chain in Orlando. That's just incredible what they've done, where they are spending literally half per capita on health benefits than a typical employer, with the best benefits package I've heard of any company in the country. You know, not only some of what I mentioned, but they basically take the money that they don't squander in healthcare, and employees get their college education and their kids' college education paid for, if you can believe that.
Yeah.
That's the kind of dividend when you do it right.
What's Health Rosetta?
Health Rosetta is really riffs off of the idea that, you know, Egyptian hieroglyphics were indecipherable. The Rosetta Stone decoded that. Well, healthcare is indecipherable for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And what I've done in my now large organization over the last decade is went out and found folks like Rosen who'd cracked the code. And all we're doing is sharing, you know, think of it as like Wikipedia for how to purchase healthcare smart, which is at the root of all the dysfunction in our healthcare system. So it's essentially a blueprint for how to purchase healthcare that then naturally leads into things like I mentioned at Rosen and dozens, if not hundreds of other employers. It's still the outlier, still not the mainstream yet. But they're, you know, it's working rural, urban, all corners of the country, public, private, large, small. It's just not the story that most people are aware of yet. And we're like, this is crazy. That's, if you look at the impact on health outcomes, it's bigger than the biggest blockbuster drug of the century.
Yeah. So Dave Chase is his name. He's the co-founder of Health Rosetta, which we were just talking about. He's also author of the new book, The Opioid Crisis Wake-Up Call. And before you go, I want to ask you, whenever I bring this subject up, we get callers in, and some people call in and they say, I'm getting hurt because my doctor's afraid to give me pain medication because now they're getting pressure because they're so afraid of addiction. What do you say to that caller?
It's a fair concern. There are legitimate people who have long-term chronic pain issues. I mentioned in a call out in the chapter one, the Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And so you have to be very careful that you don't overcorrect. There are appropriate guidelines. CDC has them. And one of the things that's a big missed opportunity in this legislation, and I think it could probably just be an executive order, is when you follow CDC guidelines, those type of patients don't get hurt, but we don't prescribe things inappropriately. And, you know, my suggestion to the administration is let's practice what we preach here, because there's a lot of federal employees, there's a lot of state employees. If you have your employees only go to doctors, prescribers who follow CDC guidelines, there's basically not a problem. And the nice thing is those same doctors treat everybody else. And so you root out the folks who are the problem and, you know, the people who actually have long-term appropriate pain. They can get treatment.
Dave Chase, so glad we contacted you. This has been great. He's the co-founder of Health Rosetta, author of the new book, The Opioid Crisis Wake-Up Call. We had a lot to talk about here, and I'd love to do it again sometime. This subject's not going away.
I'd love to do it again. Thanks for the opportunity.
Dave Chase, thanks for being with us. This is Tom Shalhoub. The number is 833-852-4866. We are in an opioid crisis, and you just heard an expert. If you have any feedback yourself, like I said, or if you were that caller that I just described,